Okay, let me begin with some overview of the lectures. The motivating question is to get a deeper understanding of what deep brains are, and a question is how do you classify them in any way? And the partial answer is known. One way of looking at things is that deep brains are conformally invariant boundary conditions and two-dimensional open and closed conformal field theory. So then you bravely march off and try and classify open and closed two-dimensional conformal field theories. Good luck. But we do know some rough classifications of that. When the conformal field theory has space-time interpretation, then a rough classification is given by the K-theory of that space-time. And these lectures are intended to explain a little bit about how that happens. Like Paul, I was struck by how odd it is that everything that I'm going to be talking about at the beginning is really based on the world sheet, and the whole point of deep brains was that they were good for non-perturbative physics. So here's a little more detail. In the first talk, I'm going to show you how aspects of the relationship between deep brains and K-theory follow from very primitive notions of sewing of string world sheets and can already be seen at the level of topological field theory. And this is, well, the organizers told me to be as pedagogical as possible. And this is, as far as I know, the best way pedagogically to introduce the subject to mathematicians. The physicists in the audience are going to be sitting there groaning, saying, oh, this is so trivial. And that's the point. The point is that the connection between deep brains and K-theory really is extremely trivial, and it doesn't use any fancy stuff about Ramon fields and so on and so forth. It's a more primitive notion. And wait a second. what's in it for the physicists? Well, I think that one thing you should have in the back of your mind, and I'll say this again and again throughout the lecture, is that you should think of what I'm talking about as a baby model for string field theory. Yes, Anton?
When you consider deep brains conformally invariant boundary conditions, does it have any precise meaning in the quantum level? Do we know what is a conformally invariant boundary
condition? You mean adding in higher genus and so on?
No, I'm talking about the level, I think the group.
Well, in talk, well, probably the answer to your question is no, but I'm not sure I understand it yet. That kind of thing will come in lecture three. Right now I'm giving you an overview of the lectures. So in talk one, as I said, I'm going to be doing very primitive notions of sewing and how that at the level of topological field theory. In talk two, I'll jazz it up a little. I'll talk about G-equivariant topological field theories and orbifolds, and make some comments on non-semisimple topological field theories, which are related to the A brains and B brains that Paul was talking about. In talk three, I'll come to the kinds of things I think you're talking about, Anton. I'll be reviewing some aspects of the construction and interpretation of brains in rational conformal field theories. The emphasis there will be on how space-time geometry emerges from conformal field theory constructions, and I'll review a little bit of my work with Maldacena and Zeiberg on some related issues to that. In talk four, I'll actually come back to string field theory and talk a little bit about how brains as projection operators in the long distance limit of string field theory is connected to K-theory, and about anomaly cancellation and D-brainless amino terms from the point of view of string field theory, this time of boundary string field theory. In talk five, which I might or might not get to, I'll talk about the limitations of K-theory. There's a group called twisted K-theory which is relevant to classifying B-brain charges when the H field is not zero. And the precise interpretation of that as a charge group is something that requires a lot of discussion. This will be very closely related to my talk here at the Avatars conference. And you can fantasize about a whole course on this subject. And I started thinking about a mythical talk 6 where I actually get to Ramon fields, which I won't get to because there's too much material. But what one should do at this point is go on and talk about Ramon fields, K-theory theta functions, and comparing that to M-theory partition functions and so on. But today we're much more modest. We're simply talking about two-dimensional topological field theory. I'll review ancient, well-known things and then discuss how they generalize to the open and closed case, which is really also essentially 30 years old. Then I'll talk about the solutions of Sewing axioms in the so-called semi-simple case and show how that leads to a baby version of K-theory. And time permitting, I'll draw some analogies with string field theory and show how Morita equivalence is actually quite important for making sense of the story. Okay, so what's our motivation here? Well, it's too hard to classify boundary states in conformal field theories when C is bigger than 1. On the other hand, it's also pretty obvious that factorization properties strongly constrain the set of possible boundary conditions. So we'd like to see what these factorization properties in fact imply. And what we'll do is we'll retreat to two-dimensional topological field theory, which will be not completely trivial, but at least easy enough to be completely solvable. So I'll characterize the factorization conditions in a precise algebraic way and then discuss the solutions of those, namely the set of examples, the full set of examples, at least in the semi-simple case. And that solution will illustrate some of the relations to K-theory. So here I'm repeating what I said before. And you should also think of this as a baby model of string field theory. OK, so what is a topological field theory? Well, for me, it's a little different from what Paul was saying. He was giving what I would consider an example of a topological field theory. In general, you have a functor from a geometric category to a linear category. Now, I'm talking to the mathematicians here, so I can use that word. And the linear category could be, for example, the category of vector spaces and linear maps. And by a geometric category, I simply mean a category whose morphisms are cobordisms, possibly with extra structure. And the only physical input here is the idea of space-time locality as formalized in the gluing of path integrals and completeness of insertion of states, intermediate states. That's it. It's that plus geometry. What exactly you mean by geometry depends on which cobordism category you choose. And you simply put that one little piece of physical input together with geometry and see what it implies. So that's the game. So the canonical example here is simply to take oriented cobordisms. So the objects are D minus one dimensional manifolds. And a morphism between two objects is an oriented cobordism whose boundary as an oriented boundary is M1 minus M2. And we identify two cobordisms if they differ by a diffeomorphism, which is 1 on the boundary. And it's important that it be 1 on the boundary, or you get very confused. OK. Now, when we consider two-dimensional theories, there's a simple classification of surfaces. And that leads to a very simple and elegant theory. The objects on the geometric side are disjoint unions of circles. Well, we should allow the empty set as one of our objects. And under the functor, that maps to the ground field K of our vector space. So this maps to a vector space. Disjoint union maps to tensor product. And the morphisms take any surface, oriented surface, to a linear map. And so special surfaces lead to show that there's an interesting algebraic structure on C. And our first goal is to understand that algebraic structure. And so what do we see? Well, we see a product, because here you see you have two ingoing circles that maps to C tensor C under the functor. Then there's one outgoing circle that maps to C, and this surface gives me a linear map that's called the product. And then there's, of course, also a coproduct where I exchange ingoing and outgoing. I'll call this a projector. And this one takes a moment's thought. Here I have one ingoing circle and no outgoing circles. Now that means I have a map from C to the ground field. So that's going to be our trace. On the other hand, if I have one outgoing circle and no ingoing circles, I have a map from the ground field to C. Now the ground field has a canonical element 1, and I'll call the image of that 1 sub C, and I'll justify that notation in a moment. At the moment, we don't know it's an identity. Now any oriented surface can be built out of these basic building blocks. Okay? You can take any oriented surface and you can chop it up into these. Then you can see what it does on the algebraic side, and in a sense, you're done computing the amplitude. But of course, the same surface can be decomposed in different ways. And that leads to consistency conditions on the data. So for example, here I've chopped up the same surface topologically in two different ways. And what I'm doing is I'm multiplying phi 1 and phi 2 here, and then multiplying phi 3. Or I'm doing it the other way around, and so we learn our product has to be associative. Okay. Now, we also can look at this way of writing the product. And these are diffeomorphic by a diffeomorphism which is 1 on the boundary. And therefore, the product is commutative. Now, so we have an associative commutative algebra. Now, we also have a map, a P, which is clearly a projection operator, because if I concatenate cylinders, I get a cylinder. And now, without loss of generality, we can restrict to P equals the identity. Because you see, the subspace on which P is 0 has 0 amplitudes with everything. Because in any surface, you can always insert a little tube, all right? And if that's 0, then it just factors right out. So we can assume that P is just 1. And now note that that means that, what is this? This is propagation along the world sheet, so that means that the Hamiltonian is 0, as you expect in a topological field theory. Now, that stupid remark that P is 1 actually has some non-trivial consequences. We have a quadratic form on the algebra, because just look at this surface here. It takes C tensor C to K. And its dual is called a co-unit from K to C tensor C. And now you can compose these two guys in this way. Okay, you can start in here, create two, annihilate these two, and get something out here. And that's obviously the same as this. But this, we said, is 1. But that puts constraints on Q and delta. I'm not going to go through the algebra. But the consequence of that is the so-called Frobenius condition, that C is isomorphic to its dual, or equivalently, that this Q is a non-degenerate quadratic form. And incidentally, that means that the dimension of this vector space C is finite. And finally, it means that the thing I called 1C is really the identity because of this picture here. See, here that cap is created with 1 sub C. I've multiplied them, but it's obviously the same as phi goes to phi. Okay. So now that is, the claim is, that that's it for the conditions. That's the closed string sewing theorem. That the algebraic structure I just described to you has a name. It's called a commutative associative Frobenius algebra. Okay. It is it was a commutative associative algebra, and the fact that the quadratic form is non-degenerate is the Frobenius statement. Okay, so, and it's also equally clear that you could go the other way. So the beautiful theorem, ancient folk theorem, I don't know who it's due to. I mean, it's essentially 30 years old. As soon as people started writing strings, they basically understood this. But the beautiful statement is that the two-dimensional topological field theories are in one-to-one correspondence with commutative associative Frobenius algebras. I claim that that's not a completely self-evident statement. You could worry that with some very complicated surface, right, there could be some extra funny conditions that you just didn't think of before. How do you know that there aren't? Well, one way to approach that question is the following. You can identify different sewings of the surface with different generic Morse functions. So every time the surface does something interesting, you have a critical point. We're assuming it's a Morse critical point. And if you continuously deform the Morse function, then you're not changing the sewing in an interesting way. So what you want to do is you want to look at the generic path between two Morse functions. And a generic path between two Morse functions will encounter a non-Morse function, for example, where these two transitions happen at the same time. That's a non-generic Morse function. And there's a finite list of those non-generic Morse functions. And the beautiful thing is that that corresponds exactly to the list of things you need to do to define a commutative associative Frobenius algebra. So that's how you prove that. OK, let me make two remarks about the closed string case. One is that it's so trivial you can compute all possible amplitudes. You see, there's a nice formula for this co-unit, which is the following. Remember, this is a map from the ground field to C tensor C. So it suffices to say what happens to 1. 1 goes to this element, where phi mu is any basis you like, and then phi upper mu is the dual basis, dual with respect to the trace. So now if you multiply these two together, you get that state, which we'll call the handle adding operator. Okay, and it's obviously the handle adding operator because sticking it on the surface adds a handle. And therefore, the partition function of the theory, just a complex number, is given by the trace of delta to the g. See, the partition function is a number in this game because it's a map from the ground field to the ground field, so that takes 1 to some complex number. That, by definition, is the partition function. Now, you could ask, what happens when you sum over topologies with a string coupling? Where in this data is the string coupling? And the answer is that the string coupling is in the normalization of the trace. If you change the trace by lambda to the minus 2, then delta scales by lambda to the plus 2, because you had to take the dual basis. And therefore, from this formula, you see that we get the scaling by the Euler character. So we can identify lambda with the closed string coupling. That'll be a useful remark later. A second remark to make about the closed case is that I had a target category, which was the category of vector spaces and linear maps. But in fact, the most general thing you could allow is any so-called symmetric tensor category. And the interesting change here is that this map here, from C tensor C to C tensor C, need not be 1. It does have to square to 1. So an example of what you get when it's not 1 is a Z2 graded Frobenius algebra. Yeah?
Just remind me, so the moduli aren't important because this is topological.
That's right. So I identified all cobordisms up to diffeomorphisms, which are 1 on the boundary. You can make any geometric category you like. You know, and then you can proceed to ask what is the examples of the structures. So, for example, you could take a surface with complex structure. Okay, and you could try and map that to vector spaces or differential form valued linear maps on conformal field theory spaces. You can put anything that we do into this framework. It might not be useful. Here it's useful because the structure is so rigid that you can actually classify things up to a point. Let me give you some simple examples of Frobenius algebras to keep in mind. The basic example is simply to take the algebra of n by n matrices and the trace to be the honest-to-God trace. And this comes up in various guises. For example, if you have a finite group, you can take the functions on the group, and the product can be the convolution product, and the trace can be the invariant integral. And then the Petter-Weil theorem breaks this down into a direct sum of examples of the previous kind. Very good point. So the first two examples are not commutative, but I didn't say that all, but Ezra is quite right. I did not say that all Frobenius algebras, that's actually why I started with two non-commutative examples. Because at this point, when I give this lecture, everybody has the idea that all Frobenius algebras are commutative, which I didn't say. I said that two-dimensional topological field theories are in one-to-one correspondence with commutative associative Frobenius algebras. Frobenius does not require commutative, and that will be very important to us in a moment. But here are some examples of commutative Frobenius algebras. You could take the center of the group ring. Think of it as the class functions on G. A nice basis is the basis of characters of irreducible representations. Here I'm using the pointwise product, not the convolution. So I've done a little Fourier transform on you. The trace is simply taking the component of the identity representation. Why is that a Frobenius algebra, you might ask? Why is this a non-degenerate trace? Well, that's the fact that for every representation, there's a dual representation whose tensor product contains the identity. That's how you prove that. And the reason I give you this example is that this is a very, very close analogy to what happens in rational conformal field theory, where you should think about the chi mu's as being analogous to primary fields of WZW or some rational conformal field theory. Another good example to keep in mind, a very good example to keep in mind, are Landau-Ginzburg models in two dimensions, where here you introduce a chiral superfield and a holomorphic function W. And out of W, you make the so-called chiral ring, which is polynomials in phi modulo the ideal generated by W prime. And the trace is simply taking the residue of P over W prime. In particular, if we let W prime be a generic nth order polynomial, then this is called the nth perturbed minimal model. And for later use, let me make the remark that this will be semi-simple. I'll say this again, but this will be semi-simple if and only if the zeros of W prime are all simple, which in physical terms means the infrared fixed point that this is describing is a massive theory. The Milner ring? Okay, thank you. Yeah, right, because of course it arises naturally in singularity theory. Yeah, I see. Okay, and the last example is a really lovely one. So M is a compact-oriented manifold, and I can take the Durham cohomology. Here I have to have a graded commutative Frobenius algebra. And the trace is simply the integral. And why is it non-degenerate? Because of Poincaré duality. So you see the Frobenius condition is not entirely trivial here. And this can be generalized to quantum cohomology and so on. But our purpose here is to talk about open and closed theories. So now let's consider generalizing our geometric category to surfaces with boundaries. Now you see there are two kinds of boundaries to bear in mind. We already had boundaries before. Those were the ingoing and outgoing states. Now we'll have ingoing closed strings and open strings. But the open strings, of course, have ends that make other boundaries. So in the picture of D-branes as something on which open strings can end. The ends move along the dbrands, and these give us these turquoise boundaries. So my color coding is that turquoise is the kind of free boundary. So how do we say this in terms of categories? Not hard. We have now two kinds of basic objects, the circle and the interval. And this maps to a vector space, which I call curly C. And this maps to a vector space, which I call curly O, C for closed, O for open. And of course, for any surface like this, we have a linear map. So our classification question can finally be asked. I started out with the motivation, how do we classify dbrands? Now I can say this a little more precisely, at least in the topological setting. The question is, given a commutative Frobenius algebra, what are the possible O's? And I'm going to answer that question. Yeah, I'll come to mixed boundary conditions later. That's quite right. For the moment, I'm taking a single boundary condition. That's correct. Okay, so to say what the possible O's are, we have to know what are the constraints on the O's. Okay? So, we analyze the O's exactly as we did in the closed string case. Product, coproduct, unit, trace. Assume the strip is the identity map, then this picture means you have a Frobenius algebra. But now the product need not be a abelian, because you cannot deform that into that using a diffeomorphism, which is one on the boundary. Still, it's worth noting that if you cap off these boundaries here, then these are diffeomorphic, so the trace is graded cyclic. Okay. So the conclusion is that the open sector is a not necessarily commutative Frobenius algebra. But the interesting new ingredient is, of course, that there's a map from closed strings to open strings and from open strings to closed strings, which I'll call iota lower star from C into O and iota upper star from O into C. And I need that because, you see, I need to chop up my most general surface with boundary into basic building blocks. And I need these basic building blocks to build that surface with free boundaries. However, once I've got these ingredients, I'm done. I can now decompose any surface into the basic building blocks I've given you. And then the question arises, what about the coherence of the sewing? What if I chop it up into different ways? So what are the conditions on I lower star and I upper star that consistency of sewing requires? Well, there are five new relations. Let me show you the first of these. Here, these two diagrams are obviously the same, because if you like, I could sort of pull this blue boundary down here to make it look like that. But nevertheless, it has a consequence. Here I have ingoing open states, and then closed string states. I make the closed to open transition, then multiply them as open strings. Here, I multiply them as closed strings, and then map them to open strings. Okay, so they have to be the same. So that means that I lower star of phi 1, phi 2 is I lower star of phi 1, I lower star of phi 2. And that is to say that we have a homomorphism from C into O. Is that clear? I mean, this should be crystal clear. I mean, okay. So the next relation comes from the equivalence of these pictures, and that says that this homomorphism preserves the identity. Okay. The next picture I drew wrong. I should have kept the psis and the phis in the same place, but you can draw the right version. And the right version clearly says that I lower star of phi times psi is psi times I lower star of phi. Okay, that says that this homomorphism from C is not into any old commutative subalgebra of O, but goes into the center of O. The next relation is based on these pictures. And what this says is that I lower star and I upper star are not really different pieces of data. If you're given one, you can get the other, because in the sense of this equation, I upper star is simply the adjoint of I lower star. So the way I always think about it is you hunt around for I lower star, and then you compute I upper star. OK, and the final relation comes from the double twist diagram. So let's consider this picture for a second. This is purely within the open string sector. Let me stress that. Purely within the open string sector. This is a map. This picture here is a map from the open sector to the open sector. I'll call it pi. And what is that map? Well, I take psi, and I multiply it by the co-unit. So it's the sum over the basis of psi mu tensor psi upper mu. That's the dual basis. Then I switch the factors. So here I just switch the factors. Then I multiply them. So that's that. OK, so that's a map from psi to that. OK? Now, it's an interesting exercise in algebra. If you teach an algebra course and you want to give a hard problem, tell them to show that for an algebra with a non-degenerate trace, that this is actually in the center of the algebra. OK? Just try and prove it without knowing this picture. OK? You'll find it's challenging. But actually, it's worth noting that it's easy to prove geometrically, because if I multiply, put in a little open string state here, and then pull it round, and then up it goes. And so it's obviously in the center. OK? Well, on the other hand, we can deform that picture to this picture. I might have started with this picture, actually. But this way of writing it makes it more obvious what the math is. And this, in turn, can clearly be pulled out into factorization on the closed string channel. So that's the iota upper star map composed with the iota lower star map. So pi is factoring into iota lower star, iota upper star. Okay? And now the non-trivial claim is that this is the complete list of sewing constraints for the open and closed theories. And again, it's not trivial to prove that. Llewellyn gave an argument for it in a paper in 1992 based on a lot of enumeration of cases. And you can also take the Morse theory kind of approach. OK, so let me just summarize what we've done. I call it the open and closed sewing theorem. So to give an open plus closed topological field theory is to give a commutative Frobenius algebra, C, its trace and unit, a not necessarily commutative Frobenius algebra, O, its trace and unit, a homomorphism from C into the center of O, which preserves the identity, and such that this canonical map of the open string Frobenius algebra factorizes as I lower star, I upper star, where I upper star is defined by the adjoint. OK, that's the algebraic structure. OK, are there any questions?
You dropped the word associative here.
No, associative is understood. It's most definitely understood here from the obvious pictures. I was just being sloppy. OK, so those are the constraints. But what is our classification question? How do we classify brains in this setting? Well, our question is, given a closed algebra C, what are the possible O's that satisfy all this data, such that there exists a homomorphism iota lower star satisfying? That's the classification question here. Now, here you run into a very important dichotomy, whether or not the algebra C is semi-simple. If it's semi-simple, which the rest of this lecture will assume, then I'll give you a complete classification. And also, I'll show you that there's a kind of a space-time interpretation of what I'm doing. This is all worldsheets so far. And I think you should look at this as a baby model of string field theory. If C is not semi-simple, then there really isn't a good space-time interpretation. But that doesn't mean it's uninteresting. C is not semi-simple is, of course, relevant to the A and B models on Calabi-Yau's. And here you can actually give some non-trivial solutions of these conditions, and that I think will be of interest, is of interest in that context. And I'll talk a little bit about that in the next lecture. Yeah?
How special are the pairs where you have all to the center ball?
Sorry?
All dotted ball seems to be the more basic one. But you can take away the pair all and the center ball.
If you just take O in the center of O, the Cardy condition might well fail. Yes. Because, you see, because you have to compute this trace and compare it, you have to compute I upper up star and compute pi. And, in fact, this will fail sometimes. It's not a projector. It's this canonical map pi. Maybe I'll write it. Yeah, I think that will not work, actually. Yeah. I don't want to try and do that on my feet, but I think that will already fail. The Cardy condition really does is something very non-trivial. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about the... let me back up a second. An example of what you want, which will not work, as I'll explain in the next lecture, but let me say it now, and which generalizes what Ezra just said, is to take the Durham cohomology of a compact-oriented manifold. That's a nice, as I said, closed-string Frobenius algebra. Tensor that over the n by n matrices. That's a non-commutative Frobenius algebra. Do what you say. I can assure you the Cardy condition fails. What? Yes, you can. And I'll have a brief remark on that next time. This lecture is focused on the semi-simple case. So let me say what semi-simple means. For me, an algebra is semi-simple if the fusion rules are diagonalizable. Or the left regular representation is diagonalizable. So take a basis, phi mu, for your algebra, and then you have structure constants relative to that basis. So, of course, those structure constants give you the matrices of the left regular representation. Now, in our case, we're thinking of C as a commutative algebra, so these are all commuting matrices, but that doesn't mean we can diagonalize them, because they might not be diagonalizable, they might be nilpotent. When that doesn't happen, when the L's are diagonalizable, it's semi-simple. Now, an easy fact is that the most general commutative semi-simple Frobenius algebra is simply a sum of fields. In other words, you can always find elements, I'll call them epsilon I, which look like orthogonal projection operators, and you can just decompose C into a sum of these, of the case of the Frobenius algebra C times epsilon I. So the only invariant is the trace of epsilon I. I'll call it theta I. How do you prove that? Well, those who remember Ferlinda theory know this very well. To say that the structure constants, that the regular representation is diagonalizable means there exists a matrix S which diagonalizes them. If I choose a basis where phi lower 0 is the identity, then I can solve for these lambdas, and I get this kind of formula. And now using this, you can check that the basic idempotent epsilon j is this particular sum of the matrix S times this basic times this phi mu. And I think many of you have seen formulas like that before. I'll comment on that. So what are examples of semi-simple Frobenius algebras? Well, as I said, an example is the center of the group ring. That's semi-simple, easy to check. The fusion rule algebra of an arbitrary rational conformal field theory is semi-simple. That's the Frölunda algebra, leading to the Frölunda theorem and all of that. Landau-Ginzburg models give you chiral rings, and if the Landau-Ginzburg model is massive, then the algebra is semi-simple. And perhaps some experts in the audience can tell me what the status of this is. My understanding is that a generic quantum cohomology theory is semi-simple. Certainly the most obvious cases where C1 is non-zero gives you a semi-simple algebra. That's not to say that there aren't important non-semi-simple examples. The classical cohomology of a compact-oriented manifold is not, because there are nilpotents. You just take your differential form to a high enough degree and it's zero, right? So that means that multiplication by that cannot be diagonalized. More significantly, perhaps, is that the chiral ring of topological theories on Calabi-Yau threefolds or d-folds is not semi-simple because there's a conserved U1 charge. Okay, now we focus on the semi-simple case for the rest of this talk. And in the semi-simple case, what you can do is you can always produce, presto, out of the algebra, a spacetime. And that's Gelfand's theorem. Okay, so let me remind you of that. It's a basic intuition. If X is a compact topological space, then you can consider the continuous functions on X, and that's a commutative C star algebra. And the lovely fact is that those are in 1-1 correspondence with commutative C star algebras are in 1-1 correspondence with topological spaces. So indeed, given any C star algebra A, you can take spec of A. It's the space of characters from A to C. And the space of characters is itself a topological space. And the way you define the topology is by the Gelfand transform. If you have an element of the algebra, you define a function, a hat, on spec A, whose value on a character, remember, A is the space of characters, so the value of this function on the character is the character on A. And the theorem says that if you start with a commutative C star algebra A, you take spec of A to make a topological space. You take the continuous functions on that topological space. It's a new commutative algebra. And the theorem says it's the same one you started with. Or equivalently, if you take a topological space, you take its algebra of functions. That's a commutative algebra. You take the topological space of that algebra, you get back the original space. Okay, and the isomorphism here is particularly obvious. If you've got a point, okay, and now you have a character on the space of functions, it's simply obtained by evaluating the function at the point. Okay, so I said that the generic nth perturbed minimal model is semi-simple. And indeed, the spectrum is just these n points associated with the basic idempotents. And this is actually literally space-time. In examples from back in early 1990s, the strings moving in a space-time of n points were solved by the matrix model. And then later, the correlation functions from that matrix model were interpreted as correlation functions of topological Landau-Ginzburg theories coupled to topological gravity. And so I think of that as a literally space-time coming out of the closed string algebra in that case. Okay. Well, we're finally getting to the point of this talk, which is, what are the O's? What are the O's for a semi-simple Frobenius algebra? What I'm going to show you is that if I've got a semi-simple Frobenius algebra, then I've got a space-time. What I'm going to show you is that the O's correspond to vector bundles over that space-time. Okay. So let's see how that works. So first, let's consider the case where there's a zero-dimensional space-time, one-dimensional space of functions. And so the closed string algebra is simply a copy of the field C. And for clarity, I let its generator be epsilon. Epsilon squared is epsilon. Epsilon is just one, of course, but for clarity, I leave it as epsilon. So space-time has one point. Now, you start to analyze the Cardy condition, and by a fairly technical argument that I don't want to give, you'll conclude that O is a finite-dimensional semisimple algebra over C. Okay, and that's not trivial. You have to use the Cardy condition to prove that. Then there's a theorem in mathematics, I think it's Wedderburn's theorem, which says that such things are simply a direct sum of matrix algebras. But the Cardy condition says more, and that's what I am going to explain to you in detail. It says it can't just be a direct sum of matrix algebras, it has to be a single factor. And that's important for us. So let's see why that's true. So I claim that O has to be the full matrix algebra over C. And suppose not. Suppose that the open string algebra looked like this. It was block diagonal. Okay. What could go wrong? Well, if it's block diagonal, then the most general trace on this algebra is some non-zero constant times the trace of psi 1 plus another constant times the trace of psi 2. And because of the Frobenius condition, the lambda i's are non-zero. Now, an easy computation shows that this canonical map pi is then given by taking the trace of psi and multiplying by the unit matrix in this one-by-one block, and the trace of psi 2 multiplying by the unit matrix. So you see, pi maps onto the two-dimensional center of this algebra. On the other hand, space-time had one point. So iota lower star of epsilon, well, epsilon is the unit, so it has to be the unit in this algebra. So iota star of epsilon is the unit, so this is only one-dimensional. So the Cardy condition fails unless there's no such second factor. So O is a full matrix algebra. And that means that we can associate a single vector space to a space-time point. In fact, moreover, now we can drop the psi 2 and so on. Moreover, if you compute iota lower star, iota upper star, then you'll get this expression here. Lambda is the open string trace, and theta is the closed string trace. And I just asserted that pi is equal to this. So you see that the lambda 1 is lambda. That's a typo. So you see that lambda squared is theta. So even the open string trace is determined. Okay. So that the argument now easily generalizes if we have a bunch of space-time points. We can decompose the closed string algebra into the basic idempotents. So x and y are labeling our different points of space-time. We introduce these basic idempotents. Think of them as delta functions. Then iota lower star of epsilon x are some projection operators. Why? Because iota lower star is a homomorphism, one of our axioms. So they're orthogonal projection operators. So I can simply take O and multiply by 1, and they're central, because iota lower star goes into the center. So I can decompose this into a matrix algebra for each space-time point. Okay, and then my previous analysis applies. Okay, so what are we finding? What we're finding is that for each space-time point, we're given a vector space and a sign determining the square root of theta x. Okay, so we get vector bundles over space-time together with a sign. Okay, so here's the general solution set again. O is a direct sum of matrix algebras, full matrix algebras for each point. Okay, and the trace is completely determined in terms of the closed string data, and therefore you can compute iota upper star. And because of a remark I'll make in a moment, let me give you the formula. iota upper star of psi, this should be capital psi, is a sum of these, of the trace of psi times these basic idempotents over the square root of theta x. Now, I think it was Anton who asked about mixed boundary conditions. Well, you see, now I've, in a sense, I've answered my question. My question was, given a C, what are the O's? Okay, I told you. That's the answer. But we want to understand that answer a little better. We found the O's, but we want to interpret them. Now, since we found many O's, we have to allow for mixed boundary conditions, as we knew before. If we have different kinds of brains, we have to have strings, allow for strings connecting these different brains. So if I label the boundary conditions by A, B, and so on, sitting in some set lambda, then I have to allow these kinds of spaces with A and B boundary conditions, and these map to some vector spaces I'll call OAB. Now, just as there was a product before, there's a whole system of products on these spaces giving us bilinear associative products. And really, at this point, you see that boundary conditions have to be objects in a category. And you can, not only is, and that category actually has an addition, because if you want to know the vector, the space for A plus B to C plus D, you simply send, form this matrix of these bimodules, as we'll see. This is called the linking algebra construction in C-star algebra theory. And so it makes sense to take sums of these boundary conditions. So the proper question is not really what are the O's. The more precise question is, what is the category of boundary conditions? Well, you might worry that introducing more boundary conditions leads to new conditions, new constraints, and really the only new interesting sewing condition for OAB is a straightforward generalization of the Cardy condition, where you allow for different boundary conditions on the different boundaries. There's an obvious generalization of the map pi I mentioned before, and then that should factorize again through the closed string channel. So now now we know what the OAAs and OBBs are, and it's a little bit of algebra to show that OAB has no new constraints. It's just given by the homomorphisms from WA to WB, thought of as vector bundles over spacetime, or if you prefer, since our spacetime is a simple sum of points, a sum of these spaces. This is definitely in the semi-simple case. Sorry? Nice question. I know some solutions, some interesting solutions, and some examples. And I'll say what I know next lecture. I don't know the general answer. I think it's an interesting question. Okay. So what we see here is that the data specifying a boundary condition A is actually in 1-1 correspondence with the K-theory of our spacetime. So C was semi-simple, so we got a spacetime. The K-theory of that spacetime is one copy of Z for each spacetime point. Why is it Z? Well, because we had a vector space and a sign. The sign is the sign of the square root of theta at that point, or if you wish, the sign of the closed string coupling, open string coupling, I'll say in a moment. Anyway, at the moment, it's the sign of the square root. I had to choose some square roots of the theta x. I think everybody here knows the definition of K-theory. It's pairs of vector bundles over spacetime modulo stable equivalents. In our baby example, this is all very babyish, but I still find it illuminating. In our baby example, differences of vector bundles are vector bundles with assigned dimension. And so that's what I consider the main result. The category of boundary conditions for C is the set of objects is K naught of spec C. This is the set of objects, which is, what are the morphisms? The morphisms are maps between two K-theory classes. Does that make sense? From A to B. Yes. The morphisms are the, yes, absolutely, that makes sense. OAB, the space OAB is the space of morphisms. It's a linear category. The morphisms from OAB is the space OAB.
Not K-theory, but whole vector bundles with a where stable equivalences are inverted?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I think I would like to do that. In this case, they cancel out, and I identify that as a vector bundle with a sign. But I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it should be done better by introducing negatives. Should be done in a better way than just saying that I have a minus sign for the square root of theta. I don't have a. I mean, I probably have to go into the derived category, which is probably what you're getting at. And that's probably where I'm going to have to go. But for the moment, my inverses are just by taking a minus sign for the square root of theta. You're quite right to object. This is a weak point. Let me say what he's saying in more physical terms. He's saying, where is Senn's tachyon condensation phenomenon? No, it's absolutely what he's saying. He's saying, okay, you say that an anti-brain is taking the opposite sign of the square root of theta. Show me that the sum of a brain and an anti-brain is equivalent to zero. In my case, I'm simply identifying the difference of the two dimensions as the total dimension, saying that's my vector space, and the sign is the square root of theta. And I agree it's awkward.
Then morphisms do all the time, right? Because you don't know whether you're dealing with the reduced space or the pair. And if you have a pair, then you have one morphism.
You're absolutely right. I might have to go to the derived category.
At some moments in your proof, you use Bethe's theorem.
Yes.
Which, of course, depends on the field, the vector space.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, I'm good. Right, Ezra. But in the applications to physics that I'm aware of, K is C. Okay, and in fact, I often in my transparencies, I'm often making that slip and just writing the complex numbers when I could have been more general. But you're quite right. Well, for some things, I could have been more general.
But what about the other
three? Be my guest. So, yeah.
So I hope I'm not repeating the previous question. But I mean, your physics argument was you said we have to determine all the boundary conditions for this given closed. So that translates in your current context to computing the objects in the category.
Right.
So what's
right.
The physics principle that tells us what the morphisms are?
Well, to say that the boundary conditions form a category it's up to me to say what the morphisms are, and because of that bilinear associative product, what I'm saying is that if I think of the boundary conditions as objects in a category and use these spaces as the space of morphisms, then I have a good category because these compose. Because there's a product, OAB, tensor OBC, goes to OAC. So if you like, you can define a category from the space of morphisms.
Right, but you haven't pinned down, for example, what the perpendicular group of the category should be. Those should correspond to the charges. It'll make a difference, as Bob asked, whether you invert stable equivalents.
I've, yeah, I think I know how to answer that, but I certainly don't have all the details. I mean, I'll just repeat what I said before. I think one has to go to the derived category. Okay, so let's see, what time is it? Oh, yeah. Well, I'm perfectly happy to stop here and continue with the remarks about boundary states and monodromy and relations to string theory next time.
You have another half
hour. I know, but people are... I'm also happy to go on, but people are probably tired, and it's really... Yeah? Okay.
Maybe the mythical fifth.
I actually think the fifth is mythical. But okay. But I already gave the fifth at the Avatars conference. So I simply change it a little for the mathematicians. All right. So, well, so we classified the boundary conditions. Okay. And now I want to make some remarks on the result. And there are three classes of remarks. One is that there's, in rational conformal field theories, there's this whole formalism of boundary states. And I want to show you how that actually fits in very nicely with this picture here. And then you can also see the phenomenon of monodromy of brains transforming into other brains and anti-brains that Paul alluded to, even in the simple examples. And then it's also interesting to think about this, as I keep saying, as a baby model of string field theory. And there are some interesting remarks, I think, about how Morita equivalence is quite relevant. And somebody said, I think it was Tony, said, isn't C fundamental and O not fundamental? And I'll actually comment on precisely that. Okay, first remarks about the boundary state. Well, what is a boundary state? Given a boundary condition A, I'll define the boundary state B sub A as an element of C by the following property. I'll say that the correlation functions of the closed string operators with boundary condition A, so what is that? That's the trace theta A of this set of operators, is the closed string trace of the state B sub A with the corresponding operators inserted. Well, okay, now you can solve for B sub A, because this is a homomorphism, and because iota lower star is adjoint to iota upper star, so B sub A is iota upper A of 1. Okay. So now we determined all this data in the semi-simple case. Okay, so you just write it out, and here's the solution. So B sub A is the dimension of that space times epsilon x over the square root of theta x. So let me make some remarks on that formula. I like that formula. I found it illuminating when I first understood it. Let me remind you that these basic idempotents epsilon sub x were obtained from any basis you like by this S matrix, which diagonalizes the fusion rules. Now, I think of this formula then. These are integer combinations of these objects here. I think of this as the analogous to the relation between Ishibashi states and Cardi states in the theory of boundary states in rational conformal field theory, which if you don't know what that is, I'll say some words about it in lecture 3. But for those who know, this you see is a strong analogy here. And moreover, if you take the trace of this boundary state, you get the square root of theta x times the dimension. And I think of that as a topological field theory version of the tension equals dimension result. Indeed, in rational conformal field theory, the square root of theta x turns out to be the S matrix elements S0x, which is, in fact, the quantum dimension of the representation x in rational conformal field theory. So you get a sum of quantum dimensions this way. And the next remark is that boundary states is a terrible terminology. These are not states in the sense of quantum mechanics. Okay? in quantum mechanics, you're allowed to take two states, and you can take arbitrary linear combinations of them, and there's another state. Okay? And you have your Schrodinger cat and all of that. But here, you're only allowed to add these things with integer coefficients because of the Cardy condition. So you should think of these boundary states actually as being a full lattice within C. In fact, a curious thing about this semi-simple case is that C is the same thing over the complex numbers as its own K-theory. Well, I haven't defined K lower naught of C, but I'll come to that. Okay, the last comment on boundary states proper is that just as we had a handle adding operator, delta, the boundary state, of course, is a hole adding operator. Here's the picture associated with the definition I gave before. So now you can analyze arbitrary amplitudes with H holes and G handles. And that's just the trace of delta to the G, B sub A to the H. And one nice thing about this is that now you understand one way of thinking about those square roots I was talking about before. You see, that's those square roots, the fact that those square roots come up in the boundary state is the famous fact that the closed string coupling is the square of the open string coupling. Why? Because if I scale the closed string traces by lambda squared, then, of course, delta scales by lambda squared, but B only scales by one factor of lambda because of the square root. Okay, next remark is about monodromy. The boundary condition, as I said, determines an algebra, and you might have asked, why don't you just take plus square roots? I think people were asking that in some form before. And one answer to that is that you can't coherently take all positive square roots if you want this theory to work well in families. And so let me explain what I mean by that. And for purposes of this argument, it's good to keep in mind the Landau-Ginzburg models, which are parameterized by a family of Landau-Ginzburg potentials. So think of S as polynomials of order n plus 1. So for a generic polynomial, the corresponding Landau-Ginzburg model, the corresponding Frobenius algebra, is semi-simple. But of course, there's a complex codimension 1 locus where the algebra is not semi-simple, that is, where the zeros of W prime are multiple zeros. And therefore, we can consider moving around that complex codimension 1 locus by a non-trivial loop. And what happens is the basic idempotents get permuted up to themselves, but the square roots definitely change sign. And I think of that as a model of brains turning into other brains and anti-brains. Here, you can already see that in the simplest conceivable example. Consider a Landau-Ginzburg model with a cubic potential. Okay, so the Frobenius algebra is just C times 1 plus C times phi. The product is phi squared equals Q. The trace picks off the coefficient of B. And the basic idempotents are easy to compute, and the traces are just given by that. Now, the general boundary state, by what I said before, is an integral combination of these two objects. The algebra is semi-simple if Q is non-zero, so now we can take a path circling the origin, and an easy calculation shows that B here evolves to B here, where the integers swap and change sign. Okay. And so the lesson is that we have to allow both positive and negative integers. Okay. Well, the last section is about a baby model of string field theory, the last set of remarks. And as Paul was saying, brains are originally thought of as cycles with a vector bundle, or then you can generalize to K-theory classes on space-time. But it's becoming more and more clear that we should think of brains in the framework of non-commutative algebras. For example, one can think of brains in terms of projection operators in non-commutative field theory. And so we want a more algebraic formulation of this story. And it's useful even in this setting. And so a motivating question here is that there are several algebras at play. There's the closed string algebra, the open algebra for the same boundary condition. And so which algebra is more fundamental, C or O? I'm really thinking I should stop here. Keep going? Okay.
We had two meetings to decide the last
one. Oh, okay, okay. If you insist, I mean, I'm tired. But I can certainly keep going. All right. I also don't want to rush through all this stuff. Well, let me just remind you, I think you all know, that the growth and deconstruction is quite general. So what am I doing first before I launch into it? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to define algebraic K-theory, just K lower naught of an algebra. Okay, and then I'll ask this question again, and then I'll answer it. Okay, so now we're going to define algebraic K-theory. So in general, if A is any abelian semigroup, then you can make a group, you can introduce inverses by taking K of A, which is pairs modulo an equivalence relation. So the pair AB is equivalent to A prime B prime if there exists a C such that these are equal. And so in the, as I'm sure everybody's seen many times, K of N is the integers. Similarly, you can add vector spaces, and they're characterized by an integer, so not surprisingly, that's again the integers. And word of caution, something that got me screwed up once, is that if there's an infinite object, then K of A is zero. Because if there's an infinite object, then everything is equivalent, because you could take that to be C. All right, now there's a very... so now if you have an algebra A, you can always consider it's a semigroup of finitely generated projective modules, FGP. And then you can take K of that semigroup, and that defines the algebraic K theory of A. So what's a finitely generated projective module? Well, given an algebra A, A to the N is a free, by definition, a free A module of rank N. And if I can find a projection operator in N by N matrices over A, then I can define a left A module by acting on the right by P. So explicitly, it's linear combinations of N tuples, A1 through AN, multiplied by that projection operator. And that's obviously a left A module. Because P is a projection operator, 1 minus P is also a projection operator. So if I have a module, a left A module of this type, then for free I get another module, M perpendicular, such that M plus M perpendicular is the free module of rank N. So you see, a finitely generated projective module is both a submodule and a quotient. So an example of something which is not a finitely generated projective module is Z mod NZ. That's a quotient, but it's not a sub. If we take the field C, then K naught of the algebra C is just the integers, because the only representations of C are C to the N. And if we take our space-time with a finite set of points, we just get a copy of C to the N. So that's K-theory of an algebra. Now, you can also get K-theory from projection operators more directly, and this is what people do in C-star algebra theory. If you've got projection operators in N by N matrices over an algebra A, let's assume it's a C-star algebra, so P is P-star, Then you want to make a semigroup out of that, and you face a problem immediately, because if you have two projectors, P and Q, the sum of those is not a projection operator. So what do? Well, the idea is to enlarge your Chan-Payton space, so to speak, and define P and Q by stringing them along the diagonal. That means you have to take the inductive limit of infinite by infinite matrices over A, and then you have to worry about equivalence classes, so that you have a well-defined addition. And one equivalence relation that you can impose is to introduce a partial isometry, or say that P1 is equivalent to P2 if there's a partial isometry such that P1 is U star U and P2 is U U star. Then you get a nice semigroup of the equivalence classes of these projection operators, and K0 of A is the Grothendieck group of that semigroup. I guess I do want to do that. Yeah, that's part of the definition of an inductive limit, right? I think that would not be true if I took the norm completion, if this were a C star algebra. Okay, now an important point about what I just said is that this applies also to non-commutative algebras. So we've seen three notions of K-theory now. We've seen K-lower naught of an algebra, K-theory of the projection operators, and the topological K-theory. And they all agree when A is a commutative algebra, because in that case we can form the spacetime from spec A, and a really nice theorem is that then all three notions agree, and that's the Serre-Swan theorem, which says that there's a 1-1 correspondence between continuous complex vector bundles on X and finitely generated projective C of X modules. Now, let me just indicate the proof of that theorem, since it's so easy. One direction is, given a bundle E over spacetime, you can consider its continuous cross sections. Okay, and that's clearly an A C of X module. Moreover, if E is a trivial bundle, of rank n, then clearly its cross sections is just an n-tuple of functions, right? Okay. So that's a free module of rank n. Now here's the non-trivial statement. Every bundle E over X has a complementary bundle F over X, such that E plus F is the trivial bundle. X is compact, okay. Then what I can do, then you see it's clear that M, I can take M to be the sections of E and M perpendicular to be the sections of F, and the direct sum here is my free module. I'm going a little fast at that point. There are actually a bunch of details. So the picture is that you have this trivial bundle over spacetime. You have the image of your projection operator and then the orthogonal projection operator, and those are your two complementary bundles. And indeed, you can use that picture to go the other way around. If M is a finitely generated projective C module, then there exists an M perpendicular, so that this is true, and M is the image of some projection operator on spacetime, and you simply use that operator literally to project you into the subspace within the trivial vector space to get your non-trivial fiber. Okay, that's the Serre-Swan theorem. Let's now return to my motivating question. My motivating question was, well, which algebra is more fundamental, C or O? And the first remark is that they both have the same K-theories. We've defined algebraic K-theory. Okay, so K0 of C and K0 of O are the same. And that's part of a general phenomenon called Morita equivalence. Algebras A and B are a Morita equivalent if K0 of A equals K0 of B, and Sticklers will probably tell me I'm a step ahead of you. There's an equivalence of categories. A modules and B modules is the correct statement. And the Morita theorem says that this equivalence holds if and only if there's an equivalence bimodule. So an equivalence bimodule is defined here. M is an AB bimodule. Well, obviously, I can multiply on the left by A and on the right by B, so it's a bimodule. But what makes it an equivalence bimodule? It's an equivalence bimodule if there's an M prime, a BA module, such that M tensor M prime, tensor over B, is A, and M prime tensor M, tensor over A, is B. And why is that good? Because given a bimodule, M, you have a map of left B modules to left A modules by tensoring with R. So if R is a left B module, M tensor over B of R is a left A module. And you can go the other way around. So let me give you an example of all this gobbledygook. This is the example that I always have in mind. A could be N by N matrices, and B could be M by M matrices. And these are not the same algebras. They're not necessarily isomorphic. An equivalence bimodule is simply the rectangular matrices, because I can multiply on. So it's totally obvious that this is a bimodule. And what's a little less obvious is that if you take the transpose, you can write an arbitrary N by N matrix as a sum of tensor of products of rectangular matrices. Whether or not N is bigger than M, that's totally irrelevant. As long as they're both zero, bigger than zero. Okay. So an example closer to our discussion here is that when the vector spaces have positive dimension over every space-time point, then these OABs are actually equivalence bimodules between OAA and OBB. And that requires, by the way, this condition here. And it also requires the Cardy condition to prove that. OK. So here's the summary. We determined the category of boundary conditions. Uh-oh. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. So, okay, the summary is that the category of boundary conditions is algebraic K-theory of C, topological K-theory of space-time, or if you like, the algebraic K-theory of OAA for any generic A. So which algebra is more fundamental? Well, the way I look at it is that they are equally fundamental. In the way I've given the talk, it looks like C is more fundamental, because I started with C. And then I said, well, OK, what are the open algebras? And I found them. They were projective C modules. And I can recover O from a projective C module. But what I want to stress is that we could, at least in this baby case, we could also go the other way. We can recover the closed string algebra from the open string algebra simply by taking the center of the algebra. And this is an algebraic formulation of the way we think of recovering closed string states from factorizing on poles. But I like this way of saying it because, in a sense, I've said it at tree level. Yes? It's an isomorphism in the semi-simple case. You're right. I didn't stress that it was an isomorphism before. I only showed that it's a very good point. The Sewing conditions show that iota lower star is a homomorphism into the center. Okay. In fact, in the non-semi-simple case, it will not be an isomorphism. Okay. But that, as I stressed, that's why I stressed before that I think that's not a good model for string field theory in space-time. In the semi-simple case, I think of it as a good model for string theory, for obtaining space-time and thinking about string field theory. It's just not a good idea to try and form a space-time out of the chiral ring of a Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay, I don't think it teaches you much. I could be wrong, but I don't think it teaches you much. But I think I find the picture, when in a semi-simple case, extremely illuminating. And so that leads to an obvious speculation, which is what I'll end with. So if this baby model is a good guide to what's going on in string field theory, then maybe we can learn something about Sen's picture of tachyon condensation, where the open string states disappear and we're left with the closed string vacuum. And the question is, how do you recover the closed strings? And it's not going to be as easy as I just said for the topological case, but the obvious generalization of what I said is that one should look for something like a homotopy commutative and homotopy central subalgebra of the open string algebra, and perhaps that could be a closed string algebra. So with that speculation, I'll end. Yeah, Steve.
So on your previous slide, you said something that is physically understandable, namely that you can't factorize open string to get closed strings. But you're also suggesting you can go backwards and construct open strings to close.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I mean, what I'm saying are these two equations. So.
Well, okay. I'm trying to translate them.
And the translation into physics is this. If you're given a closed string field theory, this is the way we usually think of it. If you're given a closed string field theory, you find some boundary conditions, and then you can. And then you can form an algebra. Oh. Okay, you get an open string algebra as the matrices on the vector space. I guess I can't say it better than. Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, so the point is that iota upper star is an isomorphism. Let's see. So, okay. Iota upper star has a large kernel. Okay. But it is an isomorphism on the center.
Is there a question of operation on how you would take a closed string theory and pull out the open string?
You mean the other way around, or?
No.
Oh, a closed, no, that's the easier way. I think that, let me try and answer Steve again. I mean, you form the open, what you're going to get in forming the algebra, in forming the boundary condition, you've already formed an open string theory. I don't quite.
It's not a constructive procedure.
It is a constructive procedure. If you've got a projective module M, you take the matrices on M. If you've got a vector space, you simply form the matrices. In constructing the boundary condition, you've constructed the open string field theory. I'm not saying anything deep.
I guess I'm saying
I think the more interesting statement is this one.
Okay, physically, if I handed you a closed string theory on some complicated manifold,
yeah,
it might be a little hard to construct a set of possible boundary conditions.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, I'm not telling you how to do that. I mean, that's what we're all doing when we're looking for brains in different spaces. We're, you know, when we start from a closed string background and we say, what are the brains? We start to try and write down the corresponding boundary conditions.
But boundaries, if the manifold is a finite collection of points.
Well, if the manifold is a finite collection of points, then I have told you what to do. And it's not a totally trivial result, because a priori you could have had, you know, not full matrix algebras. You could have had other, you know, funny algebras which are not semi-simple algebras. If you think about it, there would have been other possibilities, but I'm saying that there aren't.
So it's simple.
Yeah. Yeah. A full matrix algebra for each space-time point. Yeah.
So I would make a few remarks on the non-semi simple case.
Oh, great.
So I think one of the things one learns in working in that setting is that you have to start playing with the ghosts and working with chain complexes and working up the homotopy and so on. And in the closest setting,
yes and no.
Found this operator, I'm not sure what other people do, specified. Let's call it capital delta,
mm-hmm.
which
this Gerstenhaber structure.
Zero minus.
Yeah.
And which is sort of rotation of the circle and gives a Bartolian multiplicity algebra. So one of the first things to see is how what happens to their construction when you also allow the
You're putting a lot more structure in Ezra. But let me stress that you could just ask the question at the semi-simple level, at the non-semi-simple level, without introducing chain complexes and all that interesting stuff. I don't want to say it's not interesting, but... Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just had a rhythm. So I think that the center in the non-semi-simple case we should be looking for should be a Bartolian multiplicity algebra. And a guy at Harvard, Tom Arkin, has recently shown, if anybody's heard of the mean conjecture about Hochschild co-chain, that if you take a Frobenius algebra and look at its Hochschild co-chain, you get a limited Bartolian multiplicity algebra.
Oh, well, great. Oh, perfect. Thank you. I'll make some comments about the non-semi-simple case where I don't go introduce this extra structure of chain complexes and so on. I'll just say, here's the A model, open and closed sectors, how are they related? That's what I'll say.